Right now is Gary Thomas from the Wealth Technology Group. Welcome back.
Hey, Bex. How are you?
Good.
Talking money.
Yeah, we're going to talk. We're going to talk money, but I want to start talking about real estate right now because if you're not in the market to buy a house, you probably don't even realize this is happening. But inventory of houses that are going for sale are really, really low, and people are buying houses swiftly. There are realtors that can't even keep an inventory together because houses are being scooped up left and right. And one of the things that I'm seeing a lot of is a lot of people are buying houses with cash offers because they're afraid to lose out on a house that looks like it's just, you know, like it's a great house. Have we ever seen that before where inventory is so low that it's going that fast?
It happens usually, for instance, I could think of, say, the 80s, where we were seeing that happening, and in the beginning, and also in the beginnings of the 2000s, before the financial crisis. What goes on, and you see this especially when interest rates are starting to rise, people are now saying, oh my gosh, I've got to get into this particular home, I've waited too long. And now people finally are feeling a little bit better about the economy in terms of, if they had debt during the financial crisis, chances are they've paid it down over the last 8 or 10 years. So they're ready to move. Trouble is there's not a lot of houses for your first time home buyers out there. So they're going, the ones that come on those markets, they're going quickly. It is still a little bit of a challenge, though, for someone to buy their first house, because ever since Dodd-Frank came out, the requirements for creditworthiness have actually been lifted. So, to your point, you're seeing some of these cash offers. Now, how do you have a cash offer? We were talking, do you have $300,000 in a suitcase somewhere?
And believe it or not, I do not.
Not under the bed. No, well, we don't want to make a big, if it's under the bed, don't let people know.
I don't have it under bed, under the bed, over the bed, stuffed in a mattress, and I get nothing like that.
But say, well, I don't have that kind of cash. In fact, very, very few people do. But what a cash offer usually means is that you're not going to wait for your house to sell before you buy the second home, the house that you're looking for. So many times people will take a little bit of cash that they may have, borrow against their existing home, the equity, in order to pay cash for the second home.
It's great if you are a homeowner and you're looking to buy into another home without a contingency, because the idea of having a house that sits and doesn't sell,
frightening.
It's frightening, but that's not even happening anymore. People are putting them on the market, and for the most part, they're going. And sometimes they're getting, top offer. Sometimes they're getting, bidding wars on these things.
Right. But still, you don't want to have to wait. If you're selling a house, you don't want to have to wait for the prospective buyer to have to sell their house.
Absolutely.
Especially in this kind of a market.
Well, it almost seems like there's panic about what's going on in the real estate market. And I don't know if that's an accurate statement, but it feels that way.
Prices have gone up faster in the last year than they've had in the past. Now, it doesn't sound like much, but the average home has gone up 6% in about the last nine months. And you say, well, what's 6%? Well, compared to what you're getting in the bank, compared to a lot of other things, this is starting to accelerate, and it's probably going to keep on that way as long as people feel comfortable about the economy, because there's this race against the potential higher interest rates. You pay 1% more on a mortgage over a 30-year mortgage, and it amounts to, could be $100,000 more in out-of-pocket cost in the cost of your mortgage, depending upon the size of the home that you purchase. It can make a significant difference. But you still want to be careful, even though there's this frenzy going on and people buying houses. And by the way, our markets have never really been that soft compared to other places. So when you have a strong market to begin with, and then you have this going on, it's even a tighter time to buy a house in this area than, say, in other parts of the country.
So the Senate has been mulling over a new healthcare bill, and I think a lot of people are concerned about what it means. I think a lot of people may be uninformed about what it means. And so, you know, for the average person who may already be on the Affordable Health Care Act plan, they're probably wondering, well, now what happens? What is about to happen?
Well, the fact is we don't know. I mean, you could say the goals of this Republican plan seem to be different than essentially what the Affordable Care Act was. The Affordable Care Act's main goal was to do exactly that, make insurance affordable based upon your income. In order to do that, they basically provided what was known as a tax subsidy, but actually it lowered your premium immediately. It gave states more money for Medicaid to support the kind of thing, and created some pools to help pay for and actually subsidize the insurance companies, and as also some incentives for hospitals and other providers to keep the care down. So what the current plan is just simply to lower the overall outlay that the government has to pay for the Affordable Care Act. And one of the ways they're doing it in interesting ways. If you were to believe the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office report, and the Republicans don't have an alternative report, and the CBO is independent, nonpartisan, that would result in about 22 million people more off of health care over the next 10 years. The original House plan was going to make it unaffordable for anybody in their 60s to purchase health insurance, no matter what your income was. The current Republican plan is to cut Medicaid. And Medicaid actually, you know, a lot of people think of Medicaid as, oh, well, just those poor people, they're getting Medicaid. More than 50% of the Medicaid in Massachusetts goes to seniors, goes to individuals over 65 years old. So there's this big, you know, there's a separation here. Moderate Republicans and most Democrats are not going to support a bill that actually takes benefits away. What should happen is, and what didn't happen, was essentially to create some subsidies so that for not only individuals, but insurance companies are always painted as the big bad wolves. But, you know, essentially it's even harder for them to make money. They're just looking at money going through the coffers because the cost of health care is going up. Mm-hmm. And they need to set aside reserves to pay for claims. Well, when you're not making any money on safe money, it becomes even more, in other words, they have to set money away in low-yielding investments to make sure when a claim comes across, they could pay it. So they're having some challenges now. The whole healthcare system is, you know, basically 1/6 of the economy. It can't be fixed overnight. But we need to have some long-term incentives there in order to make healthcare more efficient as well as lower cost. We're not going anywhere. You cannot craft a bill in, you know, overnight in closed doors that it's going to address such a large segment of the economy.
Do you think it's going to get to the point where there'll be less incentive for companies to provide health care for their employees?
Well, you know, that was the original argument that the Republicans had when the Affordable Care Act was initially passed. It was going to be so cheap, companies would rather pay the penalty than provide care. Well, it's interesting. Massachusetts has had mandatory, essentially, we've had the Affordable Care Act under Romney Care long before the ACA came into existence. And if you look at studies in Massachusetts, it actually increased the amount of private coverage through companies or company mandated coverage since it was passed, because companies need to do that to attract key individuals.
Right. But the individual contributions to those plans have also increased in some cases by quite a lot.
Well, that's so true. And that's as a result of generally rising health care costs. We have a very inefficient health care system in our country where there's not the kind of incentives. And one of the things that ACA did, Affordable Care Act, was to actually reward institutions for being more efficient. And for instance, not by just sending people, you know, you go to a doctor today and maybe you want a test and you don't get it. But the point is, if you go to a hospital and then there's a readmission because they hadn't taken that extra step, they get penalized under the ACA for basically
wasting money.
Wasting money.
Right.
Wasting your time and also putting your health in danger. And so there's a lot of things that can be done, but it's such a massive – we've got such a massive problem here. It takes time. And I think one of the things that the disappointments in the Affordable Care Act is people thought everything was going to happen overnight. Well, you can't get a third of the population – you know, young people that had not had health insurance – just expect everybody to go sign up, I think is unrealistic.
Well, who would have known that healthcare was so complicated?
Yeah, who would have known that? It's puzzling.
Other than everybody who's ever had healthcare.
Right, anybody who's tried to read a claim.
Anybody who's ever been sick. Yeah, who would have, maybe they would have known.
Or how about when you got that bill back from the hospital or for the physicians from your procedure, say, I didn't even know I had that.
It's insane. So we get the summer travel right now, one of the busiest travel weekends of the year. Gas prices, though.
Isn't it amazing?
They're lower than they were back in January.
Lower than they were in January. So I've always learned that the past never equals the future. And one of the things in the financial world is, you know, you always say that past results are indicative of what you're going to earn. But who would have thought right now in July, where essentially this is the biggest travel time, gas prices usually spike. But the fact is that there's, you know, more gas right now in storage areas. It's not being consumed. Part of that is that because of natural gas as an alternative source of energy, we're not using as much gasoline in other areas. We have now, you know, maybe 2 or 3% of the cars in the United States running on electricity now, or partially. But other countries, they're being even more innovative in terms of creating their own energy and own solar power. And that's really sort of putting pressure on mm-hmm. The gas producers. So who knows how long that's going to last?
Right.
It never lasts forever. You know?
But so do you think like the solar industry, which has, you know, boomed over the last 5 years, has really had that much of an impact on...
It is starting
on oil.
It is starting to, and you don't even see it here. But when you get companies like in Germany or in Scandinavia, their goal is to have say 20% of their energy by non-renewable sources in terms of by renewable energy, not fossil fuels, over the next 10 or 15 years. And Europe is making great strides, and you know we tend to think of the economy as only us. But we're in a global world out there, and the trends are, you know, toward clean energy right now, and that's suppressing prices over time.
But, you know, a lot of people kind of judge the economy based on how much the entire economy based on the price of gasoline or home heating oil. And if it's at a reasonable price, which it is right now, is that kind of like a deception? You know, or is that a faulty way of looking at how healthy the economy truly is?
It is one factor. I mean, part of the things that also going on is that companies have become more efficient in doing what they're, you know, which are the industry is the biggest consumer of energy by and large, other than, the individual automobile. And, you know, companies' factories are becoming more efficient. You know, my office in Pittsfield, just the little things, you know, they went through a very large building. They put LED lights in there. Now, it doesn't, you know, so they're making investments in order to keep the cost of energy low. And just to sort of put it in perspective, when you and I were kids and we had a car in the 70s, it got about 9 miles to the gallon. Now, if somebody told you in the 70s that there was going to be a computer in your car, and that you were going to average, say, 30 miles to the gallon, you'd say, a computer, isn't that something in the basement of an insurance company, you know, that does that? So technology is really lowering the cost of energy and of a lot of the tools we're using.
Yeah, Steve talked about travel. I know that, you know, this time of year, there's a lot of things that people need to do to protect themselves from identity theft. I mean, whenever I've traveled, I'm starting to get to the point now where I almost feel like I have to call my credit card company in advance to let them know.
Smart move.
That I'm not going to be in Massachusetts or New England.
Right, because you don't want to be somewhere and have your card turned down.
And it happens. I mean, it happens a lot.
It's happened to me. You know, you get frosted, but it's for your protection.
Yeah, so, I mean, what can people do to protect themselves when they're on vacation?
Well, a number of things. Number one, do not use your debit card for anything, especially if you're down, and I don't want to pick on certain regions of the country, but down south, you use a debit card in a gas station. I've had more clients that have traveled down there and just they've told me, hey, that's when it happened, when I was using my debit card. Mm. In fact, we just had a couple of incidents up here and supposedly in East Hampton where there were skimmers basically taking your debit card information. My own philosophy is that you don't need to take a ton of credit cards with you. I basically, you take one or two cards mm-hmm. that you're going to need. Leave your PIN number at home. Today, even if you get your card out of your sight, somebody could take a picture of it.
Even with these chips now that they have, chip readers?
The chip readers actually increase security, but there's still ways for some of the older cards to pick up the information on that chip. In fact, we have these little sleeves that we give out. They're called RFID sleeves. Has our logo on it. But basically, you put your credit card in there, and it's just one step so that somebody can't come up against you in a supermarket. And this is amazing. People don't realize this. If between you and I, Steve, if I had one of these credit card skimmers in my pocket, I could read, if you have an older card, I could read information on it because of the way it's set up. So
And
one of these sleeves sort of impedes that.
And as you know, and most people know, that nothing is foolproof as far as taking steps. But if you have a credit card that gets stolen, the number, it's easier to dispute those charges than it is to try to get the money back from your financial institution through
debit
your bank.
Cards, right. Yeah. It's a big process. And aside from that, suppose you are trying, if you really get scammed with your debit card and you're away from home, what are you going to do? You're going to argue with a bank. You're in Europe. You're in some other part of the country. So with the credit card, to your point, you have greater degrees of protection.
That Diners Club card is going to come in handy one of
these
days.
One of these days it will. You can check out Gary Thomas and the Wealth Technology Group at wealthtechnology.com or call him 1-800-266-6793. Gary, it's good to see you.
Thanks back, Steve. And remember, it's not what you make, it's what you keep.
I knew you were going to say that. It's 7:23 with Bax and O'Brien at Rock 102. It's never...